Please join me in welcoming, in a good old-fashioned Des Moines way, Mitt Romney.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you so much. Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you so much. Please. Thank you for welcoming me with such a hearty welcome. It's good to see good friends again. And you know, people, they recognize me here in Iowa. I must have been on TV here a couple of times or two and run a couple of ads. I'm not sure, but I was in the elevator this morning at the hotel, and the young woman who was there to water the plants came in the elevator. She said, "Hello, Mr. Romney. I won't be able to be at your book signing, but appreciate your being in town." I smiled. Everybody seems to know who I am here, and I appreciate that because I need them to buy a book. So now I'm not recognized everywhere. There are cases of mistaken identity that occur. I was in the New Jersey airport and at Newark and was flying to Boston. And I was trying to be sort of inconspicuous, so I had a newspaper in front of me, and I heard a young woman shriek from across the terminal. I sort of looked up, and she was pointing at me. She was an exchange student, apparently from China. I knew she wasn't Texan, even though she had on a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, because her pants were tucked into the boots. That's not the Texas style. She came running across, and she pointed at me, and she said, "You're John Kerry." I said, "I sure am. Yeah, I sure am." And then another occasion, I was actually being interviewed in Boston at a marketplace there called Faneuil Hall Marketplace. And I was being interviewed by Matt Lauer on the Today Show. It was early in the morning, big bright lights on. So it was not particularly clear with all these lights on who was being interviewed. But a young woman came up, not that young, a woman came up to the person who was holding my coat, my advance guy, Will Ritter, and she said to him, looking at me, "Is that Barack Obama?" No, that's not Barack Obama either. But I know I've fallen a prey to the same kind of mistaken identity, because I was, after my race for the presidency that I did not win, I had the occasion to go over to Beijing with Ann for the Olympic Games there. And given my history and having helped organize the games in Salt Lake City in 2002, I got the chance to go there. So I went to the games and went to one of my favorite events, women's beach volleyball. And Ann insists I go to that every year. But we went to women's beach volleyball, and we came in and sat down. And I noticed that when we sat down, that some Americans in the audience had noticed that we'd arrived. And they took out their cameras. They were pointing at me and taking my picture. I thought, wow, that's really something. And then I noticed that some Chinese in the audience started pointing and taking my picture. I thought, boy, my campaign has really touched people all over the world. And so I said to Ann, "You know, you better sit up straight. They're taking our picture." And she goes like this. And I turn around, there's Kobe Bryant sitting behind me. So we can all be surprised sometimes by who people think we are. Well, I want to express appreciation to you. It's nice to be back, particularly on such a sunny day. I understand it's been sunny and warm all winter, right? Now, there's been a little bit of Al Gore falling in this area, right? So a little global warming has come your way. Now, if you had the chance to read this book, and you probably haven't yet, you'll find out that it's not about politics. There are a few political things in it, but basically it's broader than that. You see, back in the 1960s, when I was a very young man, I was living in France. Joni's laughing. I was living in France, and I saw a book there that was called The American Challenge. It was written by a businessman publisher there, and he said, "Look, America is getting so far ahead of the rest of the world that unless we, Europe, make some big changes, we'll end up being a second-tier place in the world. Our nations will fall far, far behind." A lot of people listened to what he had to say, and subsequently I think Europe made some real efforts to improve matters and become more competitive. Well, over the last 25 years when I was in the business world, I found as I traveled around the world that there's some other places in the world that are making some enormous strides. And I became concerned as I came here and began working in our public sector that Americans' politicians have put America on a road to decline. that we have chosen decline in some cases, not recognizing it, but that we have become weakened in our fundamentals in such a way that unless we change course, we could find ourselves falling into second-tier status. We could become, if you will, the France of the 21st century, once a great nation, once the leading nation, the if you will, the superpower, and now still a great nation, but not the world's leader. And the consequences of America falling into a number two or number three position would be quite severe for freedom, because it is the personal freedom that we so esteem that is so badly needed by ourselves and by people around the world. I can just tick off for you some of the things that give me concern, but they're in that book. I lay out, as I wrote that book, the concerns I have about what we're doing internationally. I look at other great nations in the past and say, look how they've all declined, and look why they've declined. And you'll find, as you read that, that many of the reasons other great nations in the past have become weaker are similar to things you're seeing in our country today. Let me just tick off some of the things that give me concern. One is the massive borrowing we're undertaking. We've got about $8 trillion of public debt right now. And President Obama has laid out a plan over the next decade that would take that to $18 trillion. Now, a trillion is a number we didn't used to use very much. I don't think I've seen that being used until just recently, $1 trillion. Someone explain to me how much a trillion is. A lot. Thank you. That was a number right there that I was given. Actually, if you got $1 million 1 year, do you know how many years it would get you to get $1 trillion? It would take 1 million years to get $1 trillion. Our total economy, everything we buy and sell in this country, every shoe shine, every haircut, every sport coat, everything we buy and sell in a year adds up to $14 trillion. We're going to have $18 trillion of debt by the end of the next 10 years if we stay on the current path. Then there's another problem we have. Those promises we made to ourselves, our entitlements, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, not the current retirees, but the coming retirees, the baby boomers. If we don't adjust and make those programs sustainable, we will end up with even more burdens. The unfunded liability of our entitlements is roughly $100 trillion. If we leave these burdens in place, we could end up passing along an America to our kids where they will not get to know the American dream because they'll be overwhelmed with the burdens of my generation. There are other challenges we face. We use too much energy and buy too much of it from people around the world. We need to develop our own sources of energy and become energy independent. Our schools are a problem, you know that? Iowa used to be number one in education. I just talked to Governor Branstad this morning. He said, you know, Iowa's fallen down to like the middle of the pack in the 20s. How can that be? What's happened to Iowa education? What's happened to America education? We used to be at the top in the world, and now we're in the bottom quarter of the developed nations in terms of the quality of education our kids are getting. How in the world can we continue to lead the world and be the most powerful nation on the earth if we don't have our kids getting the skills they need to lead the world themselves? And then there's our healthcare system. We spend a lot on healthcare. We spend about 18% of our economy in healthcare, and that's a lot. The average of the developed nations around the world is 12%. So we're massively more than other nations, 50% more than other nations. Now, President Obama and his friends have looked at healthcare and said, okay, there's a problem there. We know what to do. We'll have government step in and start controlling it. We'll put in place price controls and cost controls. We'll have government manage healthcare. Well, if you like how they've managed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the post office and the railroads, Amtrak, well, then you'll like how they manage healthcare. That's not the right answer. If you got a problem in healthcare, the answer is not to have government play a bigger role, but instead to get it to respond like a consumer-driven market. Consumer approaches to healthcare, that's by far the better way to solve our challenges. So let me mention one last thing, and that is something about at the heart of what America's economy is driven by. I was at Walmart shopping Christmas time for my grandkids, and I had the push cart full of toys, and I happened to look around the store. And I chuckled because I said, this store reminds me of Sam Walton. Now, I've never met Sam Walton, but I've read stories about him. He's a man who liked low prices on everything people wanted, and he wasn't a really uptight, organized guy. He was more sort of impulsive person. You go in the store, they got low prices. All right, you see the low prices and you see the big smiley face, the little yellow smiley face, you know, and low price here, and it's on everything you want. And the store isn't as organized as a Target store, at least the way I look at it. It's kind of helter-skelter, but you can find your way around if you want to, and it's kind of like Sam Walton. And I thought, you know, it's interesting. I've seen some businesses and they remind me of the founder. I met Walt Disney when I was a boy, and I've been to Disneyland. It's like the physical embodiment of Walt Disney. Whimsical, childlike, imaginative. That's what Disneyland is. I think about a computer company like Microsoft, software company, Microsoft. It reminds me of Bill Gates, what I know of him. Steve Jobs, however, reminds me of Apple Computer. Then there's that airline, what do they call it? Virgin Atlantic. It's kind of edgy and irreverent, just like their founder, Richard Branson. You see, some businesses remind us of the people who started them. And the culture of those people who started them endures today. But what's true of businesses is every bit as true of countries. What we are is very much a reflection of the people who founded this nation. The people who founded this nation came here from all over the world taking extraordinary risk. Why? Because this was the place of opportunity. And that became a good deal of our culture. Then when the founders sat down to write the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, they had a big question. Would we be led by a strong government from England with a king that would tell us what to make and how to make it and where to send it and how we get taxed? Or would we instead push all that aside, push aside that safety net, and instead say, no, we're going to let people choose their own path and follow their own dreams? And that's the choice they made. And by virtue of making those choices, as our settlers and as these founders, America became the home of opportunity. Every pioneer in the world, every opportunity seeker, every innovator thought of America as the place they wanted to be, and they came here. That's our culture. That's who we are. That's how we lead the world with new ideas and innovation. And what concerns me is that Washington politicians, some in both parties, much more severely in the last year than I've seen in the years before, but Washington is smothering that spirit of innovativeness and pioneering and technology with excessive taxes, in some cases excessive regulation, putting more and more burdens on those that want to create and build, with excessive health care costs, with schools that aren't performing up to snuff. They're weakening the capacity of America to be America. And so we have work to do. That's why I wrote this book, is saying what I think we have to do, which is number one, to recognize we don't apologize for who America is. America is a great and powerful nation that does great things. We are proud of who we are and what we've accomplished and what we will yet accomplish. And then we also lay out the fact that we have challenges, and we're going to deal with them the way we've always dealt with our challenges, and that's honestly, directly, confronting them with all of our energy and passion. And if we do that thing, if we do exactly as I've described, proud of who we are, committed to fixing the challenges we have, we'll remain as we've always been, the hope of the earth. And I know we'll do it, because I've seen the heart of the American people. Time and time again, I've been inspired by the people I've seen. One of the last acts I carried out as governor on a foreign basis was going overseas to visit our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I would go representing the Massachusetts National Guard and see 10 or 12 service people in one community after the other. And after I'd been there a few days, I said to them, you know, if you'd like me to call your spouse when I get home or your parents, just to give me a piece of paper with their name and number, and I'll call them and tell them that you look good. And so before I left, I had 63 pieces of paper from these folks. And I thought, boy, that's going to take a few weeks to get through all those calls. I got home the day before Memorial Day. And Memorial Day morning, I got up and I thought, you know, I think I'm going to bang out three or four of these calls before the kids wake up and we go out playing on this vacation day. So I made about three calls when the person who answered the phone said, oh, Governor Romney, I thought that might be you calling. And I said, what do you mean you thought it might be me calling? She said, well, after you made your first couple of calls, the wives emailed their husbands in Iraq and Afghanistan and said you were calling. And then they emailed their buddies throughout the theater and said you were calling. And then they emailed their spouses, us, and said you'd be calling today. So I called 63 homes on Memorial Day. And this was not a great time for us in the Iraq conflict. This was before the success of the surge was well known and understood by the people of America. This was not a time when these folks that I would be calling would be saying, hey, thanks, Governor Romney, for the chance we have to have our loved one over there serving. Things are going so well. And I expected a number of complaints. I expected people to say, how come my loved one isn't home? How come we're not doing something to bring them home right away? But you know what? In 63 calls I made, not one complaint, not one person was critical. At the end of the call, I'd say something like, I'd say, on behalf of the country, on behalf of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I want to express my appreciation to you for the sacrifice your loved one is making and for the sacrifice your family is making. And they would typically, at that point, either interrupt me or at the end say, no, Governor, it's an honor to be able to sacrifice for the country, which is the hope of the earth. That is the spirit of the American heart. It's why I'm so convinced that we'll rise to the occasion of our challenges. We'll not have to apologize for who we are or where we've been. We instead will be able to stand proud and true and acknowledge that this great land loves liberty, we love our friends throughout the earth, and we will remain, as we've been, the hope of the earth. Thank you so much. Great to be with you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, let's see. You guys, don't get up. That's all right. Questions? Let me take a question or two. Is that okay? Do we have time to do that? I know you have to go back to work, so I won't take a lot of questions and take a lot of your time. I'll sign some books and then let you go back to work. And some of those signs you have, the reason you've got those is so I can sign those too. If you haven't got a book, and just make sure you get a souvenir. Yes, sir. It's $1,000 billion. Well, actually, you can calculate the numbers different ways, as people do. And this gentleman says the unfunded liabilities are about $130 trillion, and some estimated at more like $70 trillion. 70, 100, $130 trillion, it's a number that is an unthinkable amount. And unless we make our entitlements sustainable, we will pass to our kids a burden that cannot be carried, and we will kill the American dream for our grandkids. And that we cannot do. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd like to mention that baby boomer retirement crisis is coming up, and a lot of people won't be able to drive, to the pharmacy and stuff like this. And in the meantime, we have property values going down.
Yeah.
Is there a way we could be creative and redesign neighborhoods in which we could have walkable villages where you can walk to your doctor's office, walk to your, pharmacy and stuff like this? And all these malls that are closing down, we can create them as a multi-use building where you can have a part of the
Are you a city planner by any chance? No? You might think of that as a career too, and I'm not a city planner either, but I happen to believe, as you do, that we can do a better job by helping people live closer to the places they have to travel. And so while I happen to serve as governor, we inaugurated a program called Transit-Oriented Development. And we said, what we're going to do? We're going to try and build housing around where our subway stops are, where our major routes are, so people don't have to walk or drive to get to work or drive to get to places they want to go. I think you're going to find, for instance, cities become places that are attracted to live in again. For a long time, people left the city so they could build a big house out in the suburb and raise their kids and have four bedrooms or whatever. Well, guess what? Those bedrooms are now empty. And I think you'll find a lot of folks coming back into town, back into the city where there are restaurants and nightlife and so forth, and we can have a revitalization of our cities. That also suggests that housing prices may be under some pressure as baby boomers come back into the cities and find new places to live. But yeah, we can be smarter about how we use energy. That's just how we live. It's how we use energy. It makes no sense for us to send hundreds of billions of dollars a year outside our country to buy energy from other people, when we could ultimately become energy independent, energy secure, ourselves. And the ideas you suggest, everything from transit-oriented development to communities where people are able to walk more. There's a place down in Florida called The Villages. I was just there. I'm looking to see if anybody's been there. It's I don't know how many tens of thousands of homes, but the people who live there travel in golf carts. And they have several towns that are part of this big development. They zip around in electric golf carts or gas golf carts. They got like four or five golf courses around, but the golf carts are primarily just for travel, because who needs a car when you live close enough to the places you're going? Yeah, there are a lot of ideas, I think, that will develop that allow us to become energy independent. Yes, sir, right here.
Yes, Governor. You seem to be having an issue with education where it's become a state pride versus overall education. What is your plan for handling education?
Let me tell you what we did in education. It was before my time, so I'd like to take all the credit for it, but I can't. Some people in 1993 in Massachusetts sat down and said, let's come together and find a way to improve our schools. And they said, what we're going to do is we're going to find out how we're doing by testing our kids in English and math and see if they're making progress or not, and seeing if they're moving up one grade per year. And if we find out that a school is doing so poorly that their kids are not moving up, if we find that for 3 years in a row a school's not doing well, then we're going to have the state be able to step in and change the leadership at that school to make sure we get it back on track. And so we'll measure schools, we'll measure teachers, we'll measure students. We've been doing that since about 1993. When I became governor in 2003 was the first time those tests that the kids took really counted. Because if you couldn't pass the test in your senior year, then you couldn't graduate. Now about 92-93% of the kids who took it that first year were able to graduate, but the others were not. Let me tell you, our kids started working harder and harder. People worked harder and harder to make sure the kids were doing well. Let me tell you the results of what's happened in Massachusetts. Oh, one more thing. We didn't just put in place a stick. If you don't pass this test, you're not going to graduate. We also put in place a carrot. We said if you graduate in the top quarter of those who take your exam, then you're entitled to a four-year tuition-free scholarship to any state university or college. So that was something I put in place called the Abigail and John Adams Scholarship. That combination has had quite an impact. Massachusetts, when I said that Iowa is now ranked in the 20s on the national exam, they call it the NAEP exam, Massachusetts is now ranked number one in all four measures, English and math, fourth and eighth grade. Those principles of testing, accountability, taking over schools that are not doing well, getting them back on track, charter schools, scholarships for our very best kids, those measures make a difference. And by the way, there's one more I think is really important. And that is, it's a study that was carried out, described in my book, in education. So read the education chapter. It's an international study carried out by a company called McKinsey & Company. And they looked at school systems all over the world, tried to understand why some were doing better than others. And they said, you know what, it all comes down to one thing once you get to school: the quality of the teacher. And they said the best schools in the world are able to attract kids from the top quarter or top 10% of their graduating class to go into teaching. And they said too often in America we're attracting from the bottom third of the class. In my view and in theirs in that study, we need to raise the starting salaries of teachers so we can attract the best and brightest and treat them like the professionals they are. You guys, I want to say thanks to you. Thank you. Where are we signing books, Eric? Do you know?
Right out this way.
Right out there. Can people get go out that door there? You can go out that door. Come on out. We'll sign your book and wish you the very best. Thanks, you guys. Wonderful to see you.